guests tonight. And I'm here to welcome you to the second of Bob Belknap's lectures in memory of Leonard Hastings Schaff. Now, I said this is a University Seminars event, and I should explain a bit what University Seminars has been at Columbia. It's an organization within the university that endeavors to see things whole in their entirety. And to do this, we unite specialists from wide-ranging fields. Some come from within the university, some come from our neighboring institutions, and some actually come from communities beyond the university that, despite the fact that they are not academic in their mission, they contribute new knowledge and they participate vigorously in our discussions. So we are an interdisciplinary and interinstitutional component of the university. There are now greater than 80 seminars that the University Seminars Program comprises. And on the table in the back of the room, you can see our annual report. This describes the mission of each of the seminars and the programs that each of the seminars conducted during academic year 2010-2011. So as I said, tonight you are all inside our special circle. Now, Bob Belknap was our director for a decade, and he'll be introduced in a moment by Professor Liza Knapp. But first I wanted to say that when he was the leader of the university seminars, he conducted us with his characteristic vitality, his conviction, his perfect pitch for fairness, and great heart, for which we all thank him enormously. Now let me say a word about Professor Knapp, who will introduce Bob Belknap. Liza Knapp is an associate professor in the Slavic department. She received the bachelor's degree from Harvard College and the PhD from our own fair institution, Columbia, where she was awarded the doctorate in Russian literature. She's been on the faculty of the University of California at Berkeley, and she is the author of The Annihilation of Inertia, Dostoevsky and Metaphysics, which won the book award from the American Association of Teachers of Slavic and Eastern European Languages. She has edited a critical companion to Dostoevsky's The Idiot. She co-edited Approaches to Teaching Anna Karenina for the MLA series, and she recorded a series of lectures titled Giants of Russian Literature for the Modern Scholar series produced by Recorded Books. She also was a literary expert for Oprah.com. This came about when Oprah's book club chose Anna Karenina for their reading list, and the website drew questions from interested readers. I should also say that Professor Knapp was one of our outstanding teachers, recognized by a presidential award in 2007 that was actually President Bollinger, not Bush 43. Professor Knapp.
As we gather for the middle of Robert Belknap Schaff Lectures, which deals with the plot of King Lear, I want to say, by way of introductions, a few words about Bob Belknap, general education, and the reintegration of the university. We all know Bob as a teacher and scholar of literature, the world's expert on Dostoevsky's masterpiece, The Brothers Karamazov. In addition, he's worn many hats at Columbia, dean's hats, director's hats, chair's hats. But I want to say a few words about him as an educator in the higher sense of the word, vyshem smysle, to quote Dostoevsky. Some of you will recognize the terms general education and the reintegration of the university as the subtitle of the book that Robert Belknap co-wrote with Richard Coombs in 1977. And anyone who has ever waited for the elevator in Hamilton Hall has no doubt gazed at the cover of this book. I confess that while I'd read other books by Robert Belknap, which meant more than I can say, There had, until a couple of days ago, always been a plate of glass between me and this book. Once I got my hands on it, I literally couldn't put it down. It's witty and wise, and I don't know anything about the division of labor, and I never had the privilege of knowing Richard Coombs, but I must say that the prose is, as Bob himself might say, though of course not about himself, splendid stuff. And moreover, the chapter headings are those complete sentences Robert Belknap always tells his students to use, as in chapter number 14, other universities can profit from some of our ideas and mistakes. And I understand that this book is being translated or has been translated into Chinese, so I guess that is happening as we speak. Chapter title number 7. This educational disintegration works together with other social and intellectual trends to produce a widespread mindlessness. Chapter 4. Universities and schools have lost their common sense of what kind of ignorance is unacceptable. And number 5. Our educational system isolates training from education and gives training place of honor. Number 6. We also isolate the disciplines from one another. Now, I know that the genius behind this Belknapian system of chapter headings and complete sentences is that reading the table of contents gives you a plot summary. But, as we learned last time, plot summaries sure don't say it all. Now, what you'd miss, and what I got out of reading every word of this, is the most enchanting love song to Columbia that anyone has ever sung. And it's up there with Frank Sinatra singing New York, New York at the end of commencement. But as really good love song, as with other really good love songs, it's one that addresses head-on the faults and looks to the challenges of a future together. He's not afraid of telling alma mater that she's not perfect yet, after all. Not only do Belknap and Coombs produce one of the most persuasive cases for general education, in Columbia speak, the core, but they remind us, or rather reminded us back in 1977, that while interdisciplinarity easily becomes just a tawdry fad trotted out to get grants, at best, interdisciplinarity can also be a powerful means of, quote, restoring coherence among the isolated parts of the university, end quote. And as Belknap and Coombs argue, it is general education that prepares us to take that exhilarating leap of interdisciplinarity. Interdisciplinary understanding, tolerance, and humility are in fact central to Belknap's and Coombs' vision of a reintegrated whole university. On a fun note, and parts of this book are lots of fun, about bridging the gap between humanists and scientists, Belknap and Coombs write, quote, "Few scientists will confuse a fondness for alcohol with an understanding of organic chemistry, but many confuse a fondness for Shakespeare with an understanding of literary analysis and imagine that their colleagues are hired to sit around enjoying Shakespeare or musing about Handel." In fact, we're about to see just what Bob Belknap does with Shakespeare, King Lear. And as for King Lear itself, it's not surprising that the world's authority on the Brothers Karamazov would talk to us about this play because, as Bob himself is fond of noting, both works, quote, "explore the metamorphoses of parricide among groups of loving and hostile, motherless siblings, legitimate and illegitimate," end quote. And it's too bad that Sigmund Freud hadn't read what Bob had to say before Freud started to make his pronouncements on Dostoevsky and parricide. Now, I assume Bob developed the ideas about King Lear's plot from teaching Lit Hum. In fact, he has written that he, quote, "knows most of the people who have taught this course since 1956, but even without that, it's easy," he says, "to recognize the scholarship of anyone who has had to discuss this book for several hours each with a room full of disrespectful Columbia students," end quote. This is certainly true of Bob's own scholarship. The imprint of the Columbia core is felt. And his magisterial structure of the Brothers Karamazov is a sterling example. One of Bob's enormous gifts to Dostoevsky's studies has been the way that, while knowing Dostoevsky's Russian context through and through, he has a terrific sense of how, to quote him again, it took 2,000 plus years of great books to produce Dostoevsky. Belknap has an enormous respect, has earned an enormous respect from Dostoevsky scholars around the globe for the brilliance and the measure that he has brought to this enterprise. But with Dostoevsky and with Shakespeare, Bob reminds us that ultimately the real task is to approach what he calls the fearsome thing, the text, and to wrestle with it. And now please join me in welcoming Bob Belknap.
Thank you, Liza. That was wonderful. I wish Dick Kuhns was still around. We worked together on the book so closely that neither of us ever managed to figure out who wrote what. it was a completely joint enterprise. last time I tried to play with some fairly widespread ideas. I tried to introduce the idea of fractals, that we a plot is made up of subplots, which are made up of subplots. And for sometimes many layers of that sort, introduced the idea that one of the central problems in literature is squeezing the multidimensional fabula in which the characters reside into the one-dimensional sujet which the readers encounter. And then I suggested that the basic parts of the fabula have a beginning, middle, and end, and that the basic parts of the sujet have only two parts, an expectation and either the fulfillment or the frustration of that expectation. I also suggested that there are only four or five ways in which elements in the plot can be related to one another in time and space, which may be treated as one or two, in causally, narratively, or by analogy, similarity, dissimilarity, contrast, that kind of thing. In drama, Aristotle felt that plot was the strongest tool at the disposal of an author for doing the two jobs that he felt the novel should be doing, producing terror and producing pity in the audience. He argued that that was a good activity for the polity because it would rid people of these emotions at the moment when they would be dangerous, as in battle. Contrary to Plato, who thought that they would, the experience of seeing a play would make you a terrorized soldier or a pitying one, both of which can lose battles. He had several suggestions for playwrights which have been taken as dictates, although Aristotle's poetics in many ways is more like his natural history studies. That is descriptive rather than prescriptive. But there are prescriptive elements in it, so it hasn't been foolish of the classical and neoclassical community to treat what he said descriptively as rules. He wanted a play to take place or to occur in one place and in one day, more for the sake of looking real. Verisimilitude was a big word with him. The appearance of reality. He didn't want to put too great a stress on our imagination, so that the Coleridge was talking about the same thing when he talked about the willing suspension of disbelief in his essays on Shakespeare. Aristotle thought that sticking to one place in one time made that job easier, suspending your disbelief. But the most interesting requirement, the most interesting unity that Aristotle has imposed, rightly or wrongly, on the literary tradition, is the unity of action. He felt that a play should have only one action. And the reason for that was not really verisimilitude. It was an unexpressed idea about the Laocoon problem that we mentioned in the last lecture, that a literary experience is so one-dimensional that it's flimsy, and you need all the tricks you can to make the literary experience hit you hard. And that if a play had one action, it would hit you harder than if two plots or something of that, some such number, were going on. So the play, he wanted plays to have one action. Shakespeare didn't. Most of the Shakespeare plays have two parallel plots, sometimes more. And that has an interesting effect. Aristotle defined unity of action by saying, if anything happens in a play that could be removed without making the action difficult to understand, it should be. That is to say that the unity of action really resides among the relationships that we've called causal in our discussions. Remarks about related to verisimilitude were in the realm of time and space, but this richness of causal connection is tighter if there's only one action. And Aristotle wanted to exploit that tightness in order to increase impact. When Shakespeare abandoned all three of those kinds of tightness, it took a long time for classically trained literary theorists to catch on. People like Stendhal wrote about it. Finally, once you got the romantics in, they could handle the idea that you gained a resource when you had two plots, which is you strengthened another way of connecting actions with one incidents with one another. You were encouraged to connect them in the world of analogy, of contrast, of similarity, and it's that world which Shakespeare strengthened at the expense of the integrity of impact that you get by having a single plot. Let me switch to three dramatic tools in which Aristotle plays a very small part. They're all connected with civic virtues or civic needs of some sort, which is Aristotelian. He sort of felt that the needs of the city trumped most other needs. The first resource that playwrights had for making a very powerful, very important scene. We tend to see in the very last scene of a play. The play is normally shaped with something at the beginning that's wrong, and then a knot of some sort is tied, and then after you've untied the knot and uncomplicated things again, you have a moment when the equilibrium that's been destroyed is restored, usually at a smaller, saner, sadder level. This is the basic pattern of a great many plays, including King Lear. In some plays, the thing that disrupts the balance of the polity or society or whatever group is involved is an eruption from outside. That's true in Hamlet. This near madman comes home from school. All hell breaks loose, and then everybody gets killed. Cliff would love that plot. That works in comedy too. One of my favorite comedies, The Inspector General. The inspector arrives from outside, everyone goes crazy, and then he leaves. The nutty balance of the society is restored, but reduced. This is, in King Lear, there's no interruption. Your king himself precipitates the complications, and at the end you have the solution. So this ending moment is one of the great moments at the disposal of any playwright. Another kind of moment that's very standard in dramatic technique is the scène à faire, the indispensable scene, as the 19th century critics called it. it's very often a comeuppance. The villain gets told off, gets caught, or is properly punished in a very open, public, and satisfying way. That is, if the first kind of scene that I talked about satisfies our social need for some sort of stability, this c'est une affaire satisfies our need for fairness and justice, equally important social needs. And what I'm going to talk about, among other things today, is the fact there isn't any such scene in King Lear. Shakespeare doesn't, there are little things. The little steward Oswald gets kicked around a little bit, but nothing central resembling a scene affair. It's interesting that Shakespeare decided not to use that available resource. The third kind of scene that I want to talk about a lot today is the recognition scene. Aristotle talks a lot about that too. This makes another thing that we want in society important, dramatizes it. That thing is the truth. And in the recognition scene, very often, two characters are reunited and suddenly realize who they are. But often it's a truth that's recognized rather than a person. There are any number of varieties of this kind of scene. Shakespeare loved them. He in Cymbeline, I counted 12 of them. They're wonderful on stage if they're done right. They're pure drama, and Shakespeare thought stage more than anyone that I know. To generate a recognition scene, you need to have people not know something. Normally, there are two ways of achieving that. One is an error, and the other is a lie. Shakespeare carefully labels one of his plays the Comedy of Errors. And in that play, you have a couple of twins in a shipwreck. Each one thinks the other one's dead. And the recognition scene comes after splendid comedy when they realize that they're both alive. It's about as simple a pattern as you can get, but that's almost the only play where Shakespeare ever used errors as the precipitator of the recognition scene. He recycled that shipwreck in Twelfth Night and in Pericles. In those plays you have important errors underlying the recognition scene. I think that in all the other recognition scenes in Shakespeare, there are scads of them, thing that is recognized is the recognition cuts through is a lie. In classical drama, it's about 50-50 between errors and lies. And if you look around the plays that you know, you'll find that ratio isn't bad. Shakespeare was fascinated by lies. You could read his plays as an encyclopedia of lies. They come in all sizes. There are huge lies. They come in all motives. There are lies designed to destroy. There are lies that are designed to protect. I think the biggest lie designed to destroy may be Iago's about Desdemona's infidelity to Othello. I think the smallest lie designed to protect is maybe Lodzis, the clown in Two Gentlemen of Verona. He pretends that he has befouled the floor in order to protect his dog, who had actually done so. People lie for good purposes, bad purposes, big lies, little lies. They lie for all sorts of reasons. Some lies are discovered. Some lies are designed to be revealed later. Think of Henry IV, where Prince Hal pretends to be to rob Falstaff to have Falstaff set upon by highway robbers. The whole point of that lie is to reveal it later. One interesting item about Shakespeare's lies is that they always are revealed by the end of the play. That's not necessarily necessarily in drama at all. Lots of plays end quite effectively with the big lie unrevealed, but saving a family, saving a city, saving something. It can be done either way, comedy or tragedy. You can conceal a lie, but Shakespeare doesn't. By the end of the play, it's revealed. Maybe just because Shakespeare so loved recognition scenes, he couldn't bear to waste a chance to have one. Why is he so fond of lies? I think one reason is they're such a wonderful thing. They're one of the great human activities. They're better than reality because they have so many more possibilities. They're better than fiction because they claim to be true. They're as creative as sex. They're as human as you and I. In fact, there are people who say that the capacity to tell an untruth is a part of the definition of humanity, that animals can't do it. It's one of the definitions of speech, which is also used to characterize people. Can you talk about something that isn't there? If it's there, maybe it isn't speech. Maybe it's just some other kind of signaling. In Crime and Punishment, Razumihin, who's my favorite character, says at one point, "I'm a human being because I lie." And philosophically, lying has all sorts of wonderful implications. almost anything you say can be disputed. You know, I exist. I don't exist. Atoms fall in space. Some philosopher, some physicist will challenge that remark. But if you say, I'm lying, it's very hard for somebody to challenge you. So it's partly just that lying is a good thing. There are other things that we can work on there, but I think I'd like to go on to discuss the way in King Lear the two plots, a plot about King Lear and the plot about the Earl of Gloucester, interact. Of course, they do interact causally, rather loosely, not terribly importantly, most of the time. If the deaths of King Lear's three daughters are all due to the machinations of Edmund, Gloucester's son. So that's a crossing between the two plots. And there are other moments where that cross. But basically, Lear is destroyed by his daughters, and Gloucester is destroyed by his sons. Of course, the interesting thing is that all of these characters are involved in the destruction of their fathers, not just the villains. If Cordelia had not lied about the level of her devotion to her father, there wouldn't have been any play. Shakespeare would have had to write about something else, because that is really the generation. That is really what generates all the complexities in the play. Of course, if Lear had had a if Lear hadn't been trained up as a king, hadn't been a subject to flattery, hadn't needed flattery so badly, you might have rigged things. Otherwise, it's not that Cordelia's lie is ill-intended. She is trying to cure her father of his thirst for flattery, and goofs, doesn't work. But we're going to see lies. I'm not sure we all feel that reason for her behavior until we watch Edgar in the other plot of King Lear. What you have there is two very elaborate lies. The you remember the two sons of the Earl of Gloucester, who each of whom actually constructs, by lying, a play within a play. Edmund's play is a rather ingenious play, that this is a lie with a plot. The plot begins with a denunciation. Edmund denounces his brother to his father and treats himself as terribly reluctant. Edmund is the hero of the play within a play that he concocts. He tells his father how sad he is that his brother wants to kill his father, the Earl of Gloucester. This is then he tells the truth to other people about the Earl of Gloucester, that he's trying to save the king. That's true. But Edmund pretends that he is telling this truth terribly reluctantly. Oh, heavens, that this treason were not. Or, not I the detector. This lie is interesting to me because many of the lies that I'm going to be talking about in the next few minutes contain strong elements of truth. They are a way that the play within a play that the liar is constructing tells us something about the liar, the person lied about, or the person lied to, and sometimes all three. I think that Edmund probably does feel a bit of horror at some level at what he's doing. He justifies it very elaborately, and you could almost say the way misquoting the Queen in Hamlet, methinks the guy doth protest too much when he says how justified he is in betraying his father. Stanislavski, you used to think that the main thing one should do early on in his career, before Soviet times, or before he was running the Soviet program, he used to think the main job in playing a villain was to find the guy's good qualities and emphasize them. Somebody playing Edmund finds really a master writer. He's a good playwright, and he's composed a great role for himself as an actor. This sense of the reluctant fidelity. But let's look at his brother then. Edgar, he composes an even more elaborate play within the play. When he's escaping, he depicts himself not as a hero, the way Edmund does, but he takes it into his head to take the basest and most poorest shape that ever penury and contempt of man brought near to beast. My face I'll grime with filth, blanket my loins, elf all my hair in knots, and with presented nakedness outface the winds and persecutions of the sky. The country gives me proof of and precedent of bedlam beggars who with roaring voices strike in their numbed and mortified bare arms, pins, wooden pricks, nails, sprigs of rosemary. This pattern of self-mutilation seems to run in the family. You remember that Edmund had been cutting his arms to convince Gloucester that Edgar was out to get him. This role is the very opposite. We've been talking about opposites. About this kind of relationship between incidents. The very opposite of the role that Edmund has devised for himself. But it's only the first disguise. Later on, he played when he has taken his father on a long walk to an imaginary cliff. He describes this dizzy height that they're looking down, and Gloucester thinks that he's committing suicide and falls forward, but there is no cliff. And Edgar says, "Why I do trifle thus with his despair is done to cure it." Then he adds, "I know not how conceit," meaning imagination here, "may rob the treasury of life when life itself yields to the theft." So what he's really saying is, I may have killed my father, but if I haven't, maybe I'll have cured him. It's a pretty extreme measure. And I think that he blames himself for this measure, because he describes himself after this imaginary fall of his father's, which his father survives. Here's how he describes himself. He says, "I saw you up at the top of this enormous cliff with something or somebody. His eyes were two full moons. He had 1,000 noses. Horns whelped and waved like the enrigid sea. It was some fiend." This is a fascinating self-portrait of all the things that he might have put there to drive his father into sanity or recognition that he should go on in spite of the horrible things that have happened to him. He picks this image to describe himself. I think this image is his way of saying, "Hey, Edgar, you're trying to kill your father." But he doesn't kill him then. And later on in the play, of course, he finally, after a series of other disguises, tells him who he is and what's been going on. And that does kill Gloucester. So he doesn't make it first time, he keeps at it, and then he kills him. And each of these efforts to kill him is justified as an effort to cure him. I think we're meant to look at Cordelia's behavior in the light of Edgar's and say, she knows courts. She knows that in a few hundred years Disraeli is going to describe how to deal with Queen Victoria. You remember what he said? He said, "Lay it on with a trowel." This sense that courts are made of flattery. Why worry? Cordelia's been living around a court all her life, and yet she takes flattery seriously. There's something going on here. She's tough, she's stubborn, she's immensely loving. She adores her father, but she mismanages it in an extraordinary way. Now, we have Gloucester dying of a recognition scene. It's a cause of death, among other things. We have what I regard as the best recognition scene ever written. I'd like to digress for a moment in getting to it to talk about the fact that Tolstoy, who generally despised Shakespeare, thought that Lear, you know what Tolstoy said to Chekhov. He liked Chekhov, thought he was a great short story writer. But when he saw his plays, he said, "Your play was perfectly awful. It was worse than Shakespeare." Lear especially got to him. He really hated the play. When he comes to the storm scene, these glorious rage, blow winds and crack your cheeks, rage, blow you cataracts and hurricanoes, spout till you have drenched our steeples, crown the cocks, you sulphurous and thought-executing fires, vaunt couriers of oak-cleaving thunderbolts, singe my white hair, and thou, all-shaking thunder, strike flat the thick rotundity of the world, crack nature's mold, all Germans spill at once that makes ungrateful man." Tolstoy gives us a summary of that. Lear walks through the heath and says words which must express his despair. He wishes the winds to blow until there the winds, cheeks, burst, the rains to flood everything, the lightning to set fire to his gray head, and the thunder to flatten the earth and wipe out all the seeds that make ungrateful man. It's at least shorter Tolstoy's, but he's turned poetry into prose, and he's turned grandeur into Cliff's Notes. Patronizing person trying to explain something that shouldn't be explained to an unbelievably stupid person. This is sheer brilliance. But when he gets to the what he really objects to, is something that comes out at the moment when Lear wakes up from his madness, the recognition scene. You remember he sees Cordelia, and he says, "You do me wrong to take me out of the grave. Thou art a soul in bliss, but I am bound upon a wheel of fire that mine old tears do scald like molten lead. You are a spirit, I know. Where did you die? Do not laugh at me, for as I am a man, I think this lady to be my child, Cordelia. Be your tears wet? Yes, Faith. Here you have a recognition scene. The king and Cordelia have met. What's interesting is he thinks he's dead and in hell. He thinks that she is dead and in heaven, a soul in bliss. And there's no particular reason why he should. He hasn't ordered her killed. He has exiled her, sent her off to be the Queen of France. There'd be some reason for him to suppose himself dead. He's been through a lot, he's 80 years old and older. But something's fishy in this scene. And what's interesting is that it's very like a string of recognition scenes that Shakespeare wrote at about the same time in his career. At the end of All's Well That Ends Well, that most people put it about a little before King Lear, the king, Helena, appears, and the king says, "Is there no exorcist beguiles the truer office of my mind? Is it real that I see?" And they assure him that it is. But you have this moment of incredulity, this introduction of magic, this distrust of his eyes, and finally the full-scale recognition. Pericles thinks that his wife has died at sea, and he has given her a burial at sea. She died at sea in childbirth. Saruman, who's a very good doctor, tells him, "This is your wife, Pericles." And Pericles says, "Reverend Apira, no. I threw her overboard with these very arms." And Saruman answers, "Early one morning this lady was thrown upon this shore. I opened the coffin, found these rich jewels, recovered her. Thaisa is the wife. Thaisa, oh my lord, are you not Pericles? Like him you spake, like him you are. Did you not name a tempest, a birth, and death?" And Pericles says, "The voice of dead Thaisa." And again, the recognition becomes complete at that point. In Cymbeline, the king, a king of Britain, as mythical as Lear is, thinks that Imogen has been killed at his orders, and then learns that she was innocent. When he sees her alive, he says, "If this be so, the gods do mean to strike me to death with mortal joy. The tune of Imogen," again, the voice is what does it. And in The Winter's Tale, King Leontes has learned that the orders he gave for Hermione's death were unwarranted. She has survived, and they've set her in a niche like a statue to present her to him. And the king addresses the statue. "Her natural posture, chide me, dear stone, that I may say indeed, thou art Hermione, give me this hand of yours to kiss. And Paulina says, Oh patience, the statue is but newly fixed, the color's not dry. But he's already touched her and says, oh, she is warm. Again, a sublime recognition scene. Here are four written, three of them written after. After King Lear, and they all have this visual experience first, followed by either an oral or a textual one. Be your tears wet in Lear is something that Shakespeare was in the process of working on and working through and working with at this point in his career. So what my basic sense here is, I've spent a lot of time working on literary sources and the way authors change them and move from draft to draft and that kind of thing. Shakespeare scholars are lucky, there aren't any drafts surviving. Tolstoy hated the plot of King Lear, basically because he thought that it was unfair. He said at one point, not in this essay I was quoting a moment ago, he says, Lear perhaps should have been made a usurper. In any case, he shouldn't be put in a position of being a man more sinned against than sinning. Something was needed. Either Lear should be worse or his fate should be better in order to introduce an element of fairness into the play. Most of you know that in the 18th century, it was very hard, if not impossible in England, to see King Lear. You saw Nahum Tate's rewrite of the play, which has a happy ending. Cordelia ends up married to Edgar, I think. They all live happily for a long time. Shakespeare's source for Lear, an older play about King Lear, has a happy ending. Tolstoy read that play carefully, thought it was much better than King Lear. Now this leads me to a suggestion about what was really happening here. It's odd for Tolstoy and Nahum Tate to agree on anything. They're very different kinds of people. But Tolstoy, I think that Shakespeare knew these happy endings, had them at his disposal, had tried a play of this sort with a happy ending once before King Lear. Then wrote a play about King Lear with a happy ending and threw it out. And that this recognition scene between Lear and Cordelia was so glorious, he couldn't bear to throw it out. And that this corner of a rough draft of King Lear may have survived simply by being so splendid. So that if Shakespeare had had a chance to talk to Tolstoy and Nahum Tate, what he would have said would have been, "Try that. Been there. Decided to write King Lear instead."
Thank you, Bob. We have some wireless microphones to pass around. I know you've got questions. The evening is being recorded for posterity, so try to wait until the mic reaches you and speak in a loud, clear voice. Who?
I can't resist. I think I asked the first question last week, but I love the... A little louder, okay. Is that okay? I love your focus on Cordelia and Edgar. And, you know, I wonder if I can riff a little bit on it. Because the only saving grace of the most recent King Lear I saw, and I won't mention any names, some other people may have seen it, was to make you think a little bit about the Shakespeare as opposed to the acting. Was it the I'm just trashing Sam Waterston. That's okay. But something goes wrong. Cordelia and Edgar are the people who should end up together. But I mean, I just suggest that there's also an instability at the beginning of the play and at the end of the play, that you don't start with stability and end with stability. That you have a king with three daughters, so there's already a problem. And one of the things that goes wrong in that scene is, I love your comparison between Edgar and Cordelia, but does she lie? She says, "Am I to take a husband to love my father all?" You know, and it is about Cordelia taking a husband at exactly that same moment, and she is telling the truth. And then at the end, you have her dying and Edgar left alone, sort of to reign, but without a queen. So the succession has been broken. So you have a fundamental instability at the beginning that's repeated at the end. But I would like to suggest, again, with the focus on Cordelia and Edgar, a counter-recognition scene that would bring together your idea of lie and error at the beginning, at the middle of the play. And that is when Lear, on the heath, comes across Edgar, that poor forked creature. And it's a very Sophoclean. You know, Aristotle would have liked it because he sees man as he is. And then has that wonderful statement about, what did I do wrong as a king? Why didn't I really think about my subjects when I did what, when I stepped down? But isn't that also a recognition scene? But strangely enough, he's recognizing Edgar for what he truly is in disguise, and it's both a lie and a mistake.
In that storm scene, of course, Gloucester sees Edgar and tells people afterwards, I guess he tells Edgar afterwards, he reminded me of my son Edgar. Edgar retains a certain amount of his Edgar-ness as poor Tom. And yes, I think the in many ways, in my own reading of King Lear, probably the most important recognition scene is that moment when Lear moves from "Thou art a lady, if only to go warm were gorgeous, thou nothing needs what gorgeous now thou wearest." That is, luxury is a wonderful thing, and much more important than need. And then a matter of minutes later, on the stage, pretty horrible minutes, he realizes the importance of shaking the superflux to the poor. It's an enormous social shift for this guy, and that's, to my mind, a more important recognition. I'm not sure it's a more dramatic recognition. I've ended up today talking about the dramatic rather than all of these other, than the social reading of the play, which I think is more important.
Would you mind saying your name for the listener to the recording?
Sure. It's Jim. Could you talk a little bit about the mixing of tragedy and comedy and the powerful way Shakespeare does that, and then, how many artists today mix genres, and how, if you could talk a little bit about this mixing of genres, comedy and tragedy, and the power that ensues from that.
People have talked about tragicomedy already there. I remember how that Polonius describes the players as doing comical, tragical, tragical, comical, tragical, comical, historical, pastoral, and so on. So the mixed genres were a part of the critical vocabulary already by Shakespeare's time. But I think that the Shakespeare wrote a good many, would very often introduce a comical scene into a horrifying tragedy, the porter in Macbeth things like that. Lear, I think you're stretching it if you try to play any of the scenes as really comical. I don't laugh at the fool in this Lear right now down at the Public Theater. The fool is wonderfully done, but I don't find myself giggling at any moment. There's something else going on. He's providing he's keeping us from overreacting, probably, but not by tickling us. It's in another way. He's common sense here, and there are people who think that the Fool was, in Shakespeare's company, the fool was played by the same person who played Cordelia, because they're never on stage together at the same time, and in many ways they're serving the same purpose of trying to get this guy back to sanity. And Cordelia does it in that speech that sets the play off. The clown continues that effort. Finally, at the end of the play, they do get him back to sanity. This is one of the places in Shakespeare
where I'd be inclined really to think that his songs are thoroughly different, although he could mix them when he pleased.
Yeah, Jerry Spivak, I'd like to come back to the introduction and your first remark with Richard Kuhn about your earlier book, and whether or not, if you were writing it today, it would be a tragedy or a comedy, or where do you look at education has come to and where you'd like it to go at this time?
About this book last I was talking about.
The book, yes.
The state of the humanities and of purposeful education that isn't mere training is pretty desperate and always has been. We've squeaked through for a long, long time, barely. And if I had to predict, I'd say, people, my friends who are scientists tell me that basically the first time in their career when they have to make a statement and design an experiment that will prove it tends to be in the third year of graduate school, that they have to do so many problem sets and master so many fields and do so many other people's experiments in the labs, that for most of them, the idea of making a statement and proving it comes very late in the career. In the humanities, you can do it to freshmen. And I think that I'm hoping that the world realizes that there are very practical uses to the humanities, but it'll take a time. It always has.
Thank you. Frank Cale, Columbia alum, East Asian Institute, 1968 Fairweather. I want to pick up on what you just said, but also go back to what your introducer said about how scientists think of the humanities and get to a question about literary criticism. So the introducer said that scientists' view of what the humanist does or what you do is just to sit in your easy chair and enjoy Shakespeare. And she was obviously showing that that is not the case, and you have shown us that that is not the case. But in your lecture, you also gave us an insight into Tolstoy, which is that he wasn't such a great literary critic. Maybe he was a moralist. Maybe that's the way we would easily, most easily, characterize his approach to Shakespeare and to Lear in particular. So here we have a great literary figure who is not very great in analyzing literature. Now, I was a French major in college. I was raised in New Criticism. I have since gone in other directions. I still love literature. But I'm wondering, where is literary criticism today, and can we talk about any progress since in the last half century, since, let's say, Auerbach?
very great practitioners of creative writing have also been very great critics. I was talking last time about Lessing, which would be a splendid example of that. There's no need for a master artist to also be a master theorist. I think they're quite different activities. But I would say that also that Shakespeare's attack on King Lear is one of the most brilliant pieces of literary criticism that I know. I happen to disagree with
you. You mean Tolstoy?
What?
Tolstoy's attack.
Tolstoy's attack on King Lear. It's absolutely wonderful. I'd strongly recommend it to anyone who comes upon it. But I'd recommend it primarily as a picture of Tolstoy as a humorist, which he wants. And he's using the same humorous techniques in that passage that I did, that he uses when he describes Natasha going to the opera and a fat lady comes out and sings a song and there's pieces of cardboard at the back of the stage or whatever. That is, he is giving a completely naive look at something that we think of ourselves as looking at in a very sophisticated way.
So are you suggesting that he's being ironic?
Is what?
Are you suggesting that he is being ironic, or is he being flat-footed?
No, I think he probably meant it. It's a little hard to be sure, but he's not the only person who disliked Shakespeare. Look at Bernard Shaw. Now, maybe he was just... I think he was just jealous. Part of the glory of literary dispute is the other guy's always rather right also. A text is so rich that you can always go into it and find things to light into and attack or delight in. And sometimes it's the same thing, often different things.
Well, wouldn't you say that in the passage that you quoted, Tolstoy is simply being a moralist and not appreciating what the author was trying to get at in the text?
I think that's actually the key to it, that as a moralist, he found that Shakespeare in general he didn't do what Tolstoy felt a work of literature should do, which is to infect the reader or audience with the highest religious views available at the time. He didn't expect Homer to do the same thing that Shakespeare did, because Shakespeare had Christianity at his disposal. I think he did blame Shakespeare for not being so visibly and forcibly on the side of Christianity as Tolstoy was. I think that that is one of the things he disliked there. As I say, the other thing was the sheer richness of the poetry. Tolstoy wanted to do it simply.
Let's thank Bob. And let's continue the discussion outside at our reception.